With a steady hand, I rapped my knuckles against the door's surface, and the door creaked open. Hickok, his back against the wall, immediately sprang into action, drawing the pearl-handled pistols from the crimson sash around his waist. With impossible quickness, he cocked the hammers with his thumbs, the metallic clicks echoing in the room. The dual barrels of his 36 Navy Colts were aimed directly at me. A rush of panic surged, caused me to drop my pad and pen, both clattering to the floor. Hickok's voice cut through the tension, demanding answers.
Welcome to Dead Man's Hand Podcast, where we examine the life of Wild Bill Hickok and delve into the stories that made him a legend, especially the stories that maybe the public doesn't know well enough, like the McCandless Affair. Today, what we're going to do is provide a sample chapter from the novel that my dad and I have written called Dead Man's Hand. And just so you know, this is a multimedia project that we have been working on. My dad has played Wild Bill, as I've said before in the podcast, for the last 35 years. And he is a talented musician, talented songwriter, impersonator. And he's just been fascinated by Wild Bill his entire lifetime. And back in the 90s, he wrote a script, movie script, that he first attempted to self-finance and turn into his own movie. And he, you know, remortgaged our home and spent a summer driving everywhere between Minnesota, South Dakota. He went all out. Unfortunately, he got some bad advice in the creative process. Basically, he lost creative control of the project, and eventually he ran out of money. But now he has already filmed the movie in the genre of docudrama. So he's actually filmed many of the scenes that he had originally written into the script. And so it's going to be this really in-depth docudrama about Wild Bill. Well, we also wanted to bring to life his script in its totality. And the best way to do that, because we don't have $1 million to film an actual huge feature-length film, is turn it into a novel. Bring it to life there. We can flesh it out. And so this novel, Dead Man's Hand, really brings to life all of the details in his original vision for the project, for the movie, Dead Man's Hand. And today we're going to look at a sample, the first chapter of that novel. I hope you enjoy it. If you do enjoy it, this novel is going to be ready for sale and by print, ebook, and audiobook by May. And there will be links in the description where you can sign up for advanced reader copies of this book. And we hope you enjoy the audio version of this first chapter. Let us know what you think by clicking onto our website and sharing with us your thoughts. Without further ado, here is Dead Man's Hand, Chapter 1.
Dead Man's Hand, Chapter 1. October 12th, 1871. The wall caught me mid-fall. I dropped my bags and planted my hands against it, closing my eyes as the grind of steel wheels on tracks rumbled in my head, moving. Always moving, even as I stood on firm ground, dizzy and nauseous. The locomotive hissed behind me, exhaling steam like a serpentine dragon made of iron.
You okay, Thomas?
Harold McCormick asked, placing his hand on my shoulder. Harold was the last person I wanted to hear from, having sold me one of his elixirs because I could not tolerate the movement of the train, the cramped bench, or the smell of the cabin and my fellow second-class passengers, especially after 7 days of sitting and sleeping in pairs on benches. The train ride had done me in, and I bought the elixir as my last hope, despite my intellectual prejudice against counterfeit miracles. But I was desperate. Perhaps the laudanum in it had initially soothed my nerves, but the elixir must have been 90% straight alcohol, something my body barely tolerates even in more diluted, sophisticated forms. After a few swigs, I had been dizzy and nauseous since.
I'll be fine,
I said, standing upright, embarrassment restoring a fragment of strength.
You don't look so good,
Harold continued, opening his bag.
Here, I'll give you another bottle of mana juice for free.
No!
I yelled, stopping several people in their tracks.
I won't have another drop of your poison, and neither should anyone else. It nearly killed me, you fool.
Harold was another species of human being. As small as two crates stacked upon one another and descended from a line of vampires who had substituted money for blood, he looked around at his potential customers and turned red.
I'm just trying to help, Thomas. I'm no fool. I know what I sell. I stand by my product. If I'm a fool, what does that make you? Here to make Wild Bill Hickok admit he's a liar. That sounds like a suicide mission to me.
Harold stomped off with his bag of poison, leaving the bystanders to gawk at me, waiting for some kind of defense against his accusation. I took out my handkerchief and wiped my brow, took a deep breath, picked up my bags, and left the train station. Though the fresh air of any geography should trump the stale molecules circulating in a cramped train car, the sight and smell of Abilene, Kansas did not quell my symptoms. I watched in disbelief as townsfolk splashed through the muddy streets, wagons creaked and struggled, loaded down with supplies, and Texas cowboys roamed everywhere in their hats, bandanas, and chaps, drinking and rioting in public as if it were New Year's. This was a true cowtown, its streets stamped by thousands of steers herded hundreds of miles from Texas and sent east for butchering. I was beyond the reaches of civilized society and about to meet James Butler Hickok, known nationwide as Wild Bill, who served as the West's unquestioned judge, jury, and executioner. Perhaps Harold, the snake oil salesman, wasn't a vampire, but rather a prophet sent to warn me. Perhaps his elixir was harmless, just a concoction of herbs and spices, and my true malady stemmed from my mission to discredit the stories about Hickok that my magazine, Harper's Weekly, had been peddling as journalism, shamelessly blending fact and fiction. My magazine reported his tall tales as fact for the sake of a gullible public and dime novelists alike, turning him into a folk hero. As a newly hired reporter for Harper's Weekly, I intended to uncover the truth behind the legendary lawman, yet I could not foresee the serendipity of my timing. Hickok had just been fired as town marshal after accidentally killing his deputy, Mike Williams, while shooting a non-compliant business owner, Phil Coe. Details at that point were sparse. Phil Coe had refused to comply with a town ordinance of moral decency and had pulled a gun on Hickok. Hickok put a bullet in Coe's gut, then, hearing footsteps behind him, put another bullet into the heart of Mike Williams, whose cemetery plot was still a fresh 6-foot disturbance of soil. These events transpired just before I left New York. What was meant to be an interview with a celebrated lawman whose unflinching, cold-blooded accuracy typically characterized criminals was about to transform into an exposé on a legend's fall from grace. But who was I to do such a thing? Perhaps the killer wouldn't talk. Perhaps he would shoot me for the mere suggestion of journalistic integrity. I swallowed my apprehension and disregarded all warning signs as I stepped into the thick mud with my untarnished boots, nearly losing my footing as I headed toward Drover's Cottage, which the train clerk had assured me was at the end of the boardwalk on the feed store side of town. I paused as a crack of thunder shook the very ground beneath me. Looking up at the sky, I saw clouds curling into themselves, barely holding back a vaporous ocean. Lightning flashed in the distance, followed by thunder. The combination cut through the clouds like a fork and knife as rain poured down, transforming the muddy streets into splashing sludge. I retreated to the boardwalk of shops and quickly ran into a crowd of onlookers gathered around a lifeless body, propped upright in a pine coffin leaning against the local feed store. Beneath the boardwalk roof, a camera erupted with a pop and a puff of smoke. As a journalist who had earned his keep documenting death in all its inglorious forms, my curiosity shifted to the man's cause of death and whether Hickok had any involvement. For the time being, however, I needed shelter. The wind picked up, whipping rain sideways, rendering the boardwalk's overhang scarcely protective. Drover's Cottage was nowhere in sight, though I could see the American House Hotel across the street, Hickok's lair. I hurried past the curious crowd, clinging to my hat and failing to shield my suit from further rain and mud as I jumped into the street, hoping a horse or stagecoach wouldn't run me over. Expecting to find a brothel filled with the smell of liquor and the brazen solicitation of a madam, I was instead greeted by a respectable hotel. Inside, the lobby was a hive of activity. Guests, a smorgasbord of patrons, some cowboys and some clad in stiff collars and suits, congregated for the same vices found in any saloon, but this lobby at least attempted to disguise itself as a proper establishment. Men gambled while women, in modestly seductive dresses, hovered and accommodated their hunger and thirst, all beneath a grand chandelier, casting a warm glow over the polished mahogany furniture as the storm turned day into night. The piano player's music followed the cadence of activity in the saloon lobby, plucky but controlled, and reveling in the warmth of companionship and shelter from the storm outside. I could only imagine the stories I would hear by simply pulling up a seat with a pen and notepad. The man at the counter, dressed in a suit not unlike my own, waved me inside just as a gust of wind swept past, sending his papers flying to the floor.
Hurry on in, Greenhorn, and shut that door behind you. You must be the reporter.
Yes, sir.
You have good timing. Smells like a twister gathering steam out there.
I had read about tornadoes in dime store novels and the journals of men who cataloged the natural phenomena of the West. Suddenly, the thought of being sent to heaven by a fist of cloud sounded worse than facing the barrel of a train robber.
Do you really think so?
Sure, but it'd have to have great aim to hit us on the chin, not likely to have the dead aim of Wild Bill.
Do you know him?
Of course. This is my place, isn't it?
I don't know. Is it?
Who else sold all their possessions to make it out west on a prayer? Who else owns the hotel that the famous Wild Bill Hickok calls his home? Patrick McNamara, that's who.
I removed my hat and jacket and let the water fall off before it soaked through.
You hear about the fire?
Asked McNamara, holding up a newspaper.
Great fire in Chicago. Over 30,000 blocks destroyed.
Yes,
I said, attempting to hide my disappointment at the lost opportunity. If I had delayed my trip by a few days, I would have gone straight to Chicago to cover the most destructive fire to hit a major American city. But here I was on a suicide mission, as proclaimed by Harold the Snake Oil Salesman.
That's a shame. I've been to Chicago,
continued the hotel owner, smacking the newspaper with the back of his fingers.
They say hundreds are dead. The city's all but gone, just ashes. But here you are, a big city reporter in our little cow town.
Readers are still interested in your marshal, I said.
He's no longer marshal. The city council made him turn in his badge.
Fired?
Patrick McNamara's eyes furrowed, and he leaned in and whispered,
Best not remind him of that fact. He's sore about the whole situation, and the terrible business with his deputy. Just a shame, a sad shame.
I wasn't going to let some small-town hotel owner scare me. Besides, how could Hickok hear a word from his hotel room with this cacophony of spirited revelry and weather?
You're suggesting Mr. Hickok isn't a tame man, I said without lowering my voice.
Are you kidding, Mr. Henry? You're about as green under the collar as those city clothes. He's no more tame than a trapped bear. But if you're on the right side of the law, or you provide his meals, he'll be your fiercest defender, unless you pester him with a bunch of greenhorn questions. I'd watch it if I were you.
Much obliged, I replied, heading for the stairs, aware that this man would offer no objectivity for my story.
Which room?
First door on the right. Would you like me to hold on to your bags during your interview?
That would be very hospitable of you. I'm looking forward to getting settled later, I said.
The American House Hotel is hospitality at your service, but just one more word of advice, Greenhorn.
He added, his voice laced with concern.
He's been drinking all day.
I glanced at the grandfather clock in the hotel foyer. It was already past 6 p.m. The train and stagecoach connection had delayed my arrival in town. I hadn't eaten since breakfast, but the culmination of weeks of preparing for this trip and the actual journey had dampened all other appetites.
Thanks for the tip.
It's a shame, you know.
What?
I asked, stopping halfway up the stairs.
That they fired him, accident or not. No one is safe here anymore. I'd watch your back in town, boy. No one is going to save you without Hickok as marshal. Do you have a place to stay?
Yeah, Drover's Cottage.
Sure, that's a nice place. But you'll sleep a lot better knowing that nobody's going to slit your throat at night for those shiny boots you're wearing.
I'll keep that in mind, I said as I continued my ascent.
It was good to know that Hickok should be approached with caution. Even the most credible accounts dating back to the Civil War claimed Hickok had killed over 100 men. But that was the problem. Even the credible accounts, such as my magazine's coverage of the McCandless Massacre, portrayed Hickok as a hero, embellishing the shootout and attributing more victims to his gun than there actually were, as if a higher death toll improved his character and image. The public's fascination with the West, with its medieval-like appeal, fueled both Hickok's aura and the magazine's sales. The stories were written by men who dreamed of heading west, or who simply wanted to make a name for themselves, sacrificing journalistic integrity in the process. Outside the door, I heard a glass bottle drop and roll on the floor, followed by a splash of liquid and the curse of someone clumsily handling the bottle. If he was drunk, he might actually talk and accidentally reveal some truth, or just shoot me dead. I smoothed out my coat and inhaled deeply, mentally preparing for the encounter. With a steady hand, I wrapped my knuckles against the door's surface, and the door creaked open. Hickok, his back against the wall, immediately sprang into action, drawing the pearl-handled pistols from the crimson sash around his waist. With impossible quickness, he cocked the hammers with his thumbs, the metallic clicks echoing in the room. The dual barrels of his 36 Navy Colts were aimed directly at me. A rush of panic surged, caused me to drop my pad and pen, both clattering to the floor. Hickok's voice cut through the tension, demanding answers.
Who the hell are you?
His tone serious as death. I fumbled to grasp my pen and pad from the floor, as if I were a marionette with tangled strings. When I finally picked them up, my hands shook so much that I had to put them in my pockets. I couldn't believe my shame. Was this the truth I was seeking? That I would crumble at the sight of guns? That I would wilt in the presence of the man whose legend I hoped to expose? My name is Thomas Henry of Harper's Weekly, I stammered. With a fluid motion, Hickok returned his pistols to the crimson sash, the shiny barrels disappearing from view. Dressed in attire befitting his reputation, Wild Bill looked like he had stepped out of a dime store illustration, though his clothes were more wrinkled and his flesh marked by time. His long hair spilled over the sides of his not unhandsome face. His signature mustache concealed his top lip, while his piercing blue eyes held a lifetime of calluses tougher than the leather of his boots. His well-known wide-brimmed hat rested on the table. Leaning back in the chair, one leg casually crossed over the other, Wild Bill exuded a sense of command, like a judge and jury for any soul who crossed his threshold. The room around us seemed to fade into the background, as if the world itself quieted in anticipation of his next move. The gunslinger's demeanor shifted, a calculated ease replacing the initial threat.
Shut the door behind you. It's the only warning I have.
In that moment, I realized that Hickok wasn't trying to intimidate me when I accidentally opened his door. He expected someone with a grudge, or someone looking for a shortcut to glory to come through that door and catch him in a compromised position. In that split second, he sized me up and decided to leave my eastern carcass intact.
You here to put the literary nails in my reputation?
What?
You're going to air my dirty laundry in cheap words for the world to see? You know it's not the bullets that are killing people out here, but the printed words in magazines like Harper's attracting lawlessness and trouble.
You agreed to the interview, Mr. Hickok. At least that's what you said in your letter.
Never wanted it.
I don't understand. I have your letter here in my bag with your signature.
Your letter was all I had left in a poker game. The fellas knew I hate reporters worse than horse thieves. Obviously, I lost that hand. They didn't let me leave the table until I wrote you back.
He reached for the bottle of liquor on the table, but it was empty.
You paying in gold or bills?
Bills,
I replied, frantically searching the bag slung over my shoulder. I pulled out the union bills and held them out, unwilling to risk encroaching on the tall man's space.
Bring it here.
I approached, feeling as if I were indeed in a bear's den. Hickok took the money and counted it.
Have a seat,
he said, his voice softening, a glimpse of regret in his tone.
I hope you don't take offense to my inhospitality. I've got every sodbuster under the sun ready to put this old dandy 6 feet under.
I forced myself to be strong and steadied my voice, despite my shaking hands.
I am offering you an opportunity, Mr. Hickok, a chance to have your life on the plains, your journey as an Indian scout, a gunfighter, and even as a U.S. Marshal documented in an honest account. This time, you have the chance to set the record straight. With the unfortunate death of your deputy, the public will want to know the truth.
Hickok's brows furrowed as he pulled the union bills from the table and set them aside.
Take your money back. I don't need your story. I've already explained my actions to the justice, and the city council is satisfied as long as I leave town without a fight. You caught me on my last night in Abilene. Why don't you instead write in your magazine that I'm retired so people can leave me the hell alone?
But that is why I am here, Mr. Hickok. To right the wrongs that my magazine has done by making you out to be bigger than life. Certainly, more men are dead because they think you're some mythical, invincible character. That's a lot of pressure, and a heavy burden of dead souls on one person's conscience.
The only difference between the men I have hunted and killed my whole life and the likes of you is just a few miles down one trail rather than the other. Do you know the trail you're on?
Yes, the truth.
Journalists are only interested in building up or tearing down. That's not truth.
I'm not here to tear anyone down, I said, aware that I was neither responsible for the gunslinger's words nor the public's reaction to them.
You've got 1 hour, Thomas.
Suddenly, I found myself at a loss for words. If I truly had only an hour to do justice to this story, I didn't have time for poorly framed questions. Shaking or not, I grabbed my pen, ink, and pad, and pointed to the table at the center of the room.
Have a seat,
he invited. I struggled to find a starting point. Would it make sense to start at the beginning, or did it matter where a man came from if his current self was the only consequence? Can you tell me about the gunfight that led to your deputy's death?
A mistake.
Whose? Yours or his?
You drink whiskey?
Not this early in the day, I replied, although I avoided hard liquor, especially whiskey. It was the drink of drunkards, saloon hounds, or men seeking liquid courage. Besides, I had enough poison in my system to cure any inclination for booze. Hickok picked up a full bottle from the floor near his bed and poured himself a drink, the amber liquid gleaming in the glass. He then poured a second one for me.
This will take the edge off.
Hickok raised his glass, somber reverence in his eyes.
Here's to Mike Williams, a good deputy and even better friend. May God rest his soul.
The sentiment hung in the air, a moment of remembrance for perhaps other fallen comrades or indiscriminately killed men. Who truly knew the excesses of Hickok's pistoleering? I drank to his toast, but the harsh liquor proved too much, and I coughed, spewing the liquid onto the floor. My tender throat and unaccustomed stomach rebelled, leaving me momentarily breathless while Hickok downed his drink with practiced ease, flowing as smoothly as water.
I see you're not accustomed to the drink, Thomas.
Hickok observed with a hint of humor in his voice, though any trace of a smile was hidden beneath his mustache.
I don't plan on staying out here long enough to get used to anything,
I said, forcing myself not to throw up, then settled back into the chair. Suddenly, a flash of metal flung from Hickok's hand and thudded on the table, startling me as I gripped my chair. It was a badge that read, U.S. Marshal.
Take that back with you as a souvenir,
Hickok said, his tone laced with resignation and bitterness.
The city council fired me, and there's no way I'm walking down there to give them the pleasure.
I held it, heavier than I expected, smelling of the gun smoke it had absorbed as a witness to his questionable actions.
Tell me what really happened between you and Mike Williams, I pressed. I don't mean any disrespect, but I need to understand how you could shoot your own deputy and friend through the heart by accident.
The question stemmed from the reckless journalistic curiosity that flowed from my soul like the Mississippi searching for the ocean, indifferent to the obstacles in its path. His eyes drifted to the door behind me, as if he were staring at a ghost that wouldn't leave us. I felt like a losing bet in his gaze.
There are other things you need to understand if you are to grasp what happened that night.
What things?
Things I never want to see reported in my lifetime.
But that's why I'm here to record your story. To help everyone understand how a man not only becomes a legend, but also lives in the shadow of that legend. We must explore what occurs in that shadow that remains unknown to others.
I know why you're here. You're no different than the fools who turned my campfire stories into gospel, then plastered them across every newspaper until I had a big target on my back. Every kid wanting to make a name for himself aims to cut me down.
I'm sorry,
I said, confused.
I thought you were at least going to give me an hour.
Hickok rubbed his eyes with both hands. When he finished pressing them into his skull, he pulled out a deck of cards and began shuffling them. He finally flicked his bloodshot eyes in my direction and said,
I guess it makes no difference. I'm a dead man walking. Without a badge, I don't have justice to support me, and I only have 2 eyes, both of which can see only one side of the world at a time. My time is near. So let's do this. Might as well have something to pay my ticket out of town.
I was startled by his frankness, the desolation of his soul, and the realization that he was on his way out.
Get on with it, Thomas.
Well, Mr. Hickok, Mike Williams isn't the first friend of yours you've gunned down. You shot Davis Tutt through the heart.
What led to that killing?
I believed he had given me permission to ask hard questions, but the wind rebuked me and blew through the partially open window, shifting the paintings on the walls, blowing off my bowler hat, and scattering all 52 cards across the table. Hickok pulled one of his pistols and leaned out the window as if to confront the storm like another unwelcome guest. I felt the remnants of rain whip through the open window as the room darkened. The next moment, Hickok stepped away from the window, grabbed his hat off the table, and exited the room, his breath heavy and his footsteps uneven from the effects of drinking. Unsure of what to do, I looked outside, half expecting to see a tornado, as thunder shook the hotel like a small crate. The rain intensified from whipping droplets to a deafening downpour. In the middle of the street, a man with a shotgun approached the hotel, moving cautiously one short step at a time through the splashing mud, using his free hand to hold his hat down. Hickok appeared from below, his hat flying off his head, no longer holding his pistol. He approached the man with the shotgun until they stood only a few feet apart and began yelling as lightning struck the sky above. The man didn't respond, or if he did, I couldn't hear him over the wind and rain. Instead, he lifted the shotgun and aimed it at Hickok, who, in one swift motion, grabbed the shotgun and struck the man over the head with it. The man fell like a sack of grain, splashing face first into the mud. Hickok crossed the street to retrieve his hat, and then returned to the unconscious man, took him by the arm, and dragged him toward the hotel. I didn't know what to do, so I closed the window and waited for Hickok to return. Finally, I heard the thud of footsteps on the stairs below, and then Hickok's shadow filled the doorway, water dripping onto the floorboards. He wavered slightly, needing to grab the door to steady himself. He stood there as if waiting for me to invite him in.
"You need to get yourself dry, Mr. Hickok, so you don't catch cold," I said, standing. "I will leave you to your privacy."
"Sit down,"
he growled and then stumbled to his chair. The effects of a day spent drinking, coupled with the loss of his job and friend, and the effort of disarming a man trying to kill him in the cold rain, had left him pale and weak, yet somehow, that only heightened his larger-than-life presence.
"Maybe you're right,"
I said, grasping the gravity of the situation.
"Perhaps I shouldn't interview you now until this trouble has blown over."
"If you want your story, this is it."
He scooted his chair into the corner of the wall and leaned back, his long, wet hair stuck to the green wallpaper like a thick, shiny pelt. He closed his eyes. I waited, listening for the rhythm of his breathing that would signal sleep so I could slip away, but I didn't know him well enough. The wind and rain had calmed in just a few minutes, perhaps a sign that the tornado had found its mark elsewhere. I realized I was shaking again, or perhaps I hadn't stopped, especially considering how close I had come to witnessing Hickok killed in cold blood and his unflinching response. Was the man from the hotel lobby below? Would he wake up and come shooting through the door? I grabbed my pen and blank pad and stood to leave.
"Sit down, Thomas."
His voice commanded authority. Even stripped of his badge, Hickok still held sway over every man in this town. "Who was that out there?"
"No one, or he'd be dead."
"Do you know anything about the corpse they were photographing today?"
He sighed, his breathing becoming shallow, his voice barely above a whisper.
"That was John Murray, a good kid who decided to raise hell since there's no official law on duty."
"Who killed him?" I inquired.
"His best friend."
Hickok's eyes widened as if waking from a hazy dream.
"Just a word of advice,"
he warned.
"You should head out after this interview. Blood is going to pour on the streets of Abilene, much like it did before I became the law."
"That sounds ominous," I said.
"You have no idea, Thomas. This is the real West. The cowboys come into this town with appetites so deep from weeks on the trail that they don't know what they want. So they keep drinking, fighting, and whoring until someone's beaten or dead. To make matters worse, there's a pact among Philco's associates and relatives to kill me, and there's no telling when they're coming. It could be a long night."
"Was that one of Philco's men?" I asked.
"I reckon."
"Should I be worried?"
Something about that question aroused Hickok's humor.
"Not from what I've seen,"
he said.
"Besides, John Wesley Hardin is in town."
Hardin was a killer in the most textbook of terms.
"But everyone knows he's got my back,"
Hickok reassured me. "Maybe I should go," I said, hearing a creak on the stairs outside the room. I couldn't believe I had stepped into a trap, a planned ambush, and that my only value was as a distraction. I tossed my pen and pad into my bag and sprang to the door, convinced I had good reason to leave and could no longer be seduced by the allure of a cover story.
Listen, Thomas. You sit with me tonight, and not only will I make sure you see the light of day tomorrow, but I will also come clean. No embellishments. No bluffing. But I wouldn't hand it over to the money grubbers at Harper's Weekly so they can profit off it. They'll change it to their liking. Instead, take down my entire story and piece it together for yourself.
You mean an authorized biography?
Sure.
Why me? What made you change your mind in the past half hour?
Hickok squinted and blinked at me before gouging his eyes again.
You've got me thinking about life, Thomas. Maybe I should leave a record of what I've witnessed, a true account of events, and not just leave my life for hack writers and dime store novelists.
Hickok's offer was more than any reporter could dream of. I could see that his soul was burdened and needed confession. But could I really betray my employer by withholding the complete story? I could still write a feature about the killing of Phil Coe and Mike Williams, but an authorized biography could change my life.
I guess that means I'll have to take that train with you out of town, I admitted.
I took out my watch, and though it was still early, I was tired and sore and dreamed of a hot bath and bed on which to straighten my back and stretch my legs.
Does that mean you want to pack it in and talk on the train?
He asked.
Where are you staying?
Drover's Cottage.
It's a long ride out east,
said Hickok.
Plenty of time for an interview. But if you want to go to your hotel, I'd better walk you there. No telling who's waiting in the shadows.
I couldn't tell if staying with Hickok or checking into a different hotel would be safer. All I knew was that I couldn't imagine walking out of this hotel alone.
Let's get started,
I said, assuming I would spend another night void of sleep, though preferable to the rest offered by conspiring forces. Hickok leaned forward, letting the front legs of his chair hit the floor as he reached for the whiskey bottle on the table. For the first time, I noticed the bloodshot whites of his eyes, the bags beneath them, a sign of several sleepless nights and a continuous drunken haze that never shut down long enough for him to dream of Mike Williams falling dead at the flick of his own finger. Or was he just staying awake, anticipating someone else to stroll down the street with a gun? Summoning a courage I didn't know I had, I grabbed the whiskey bottle before Hickok could reach it. If I'm going to interview you, no more drinking tonight. I need you awake.
We didn't agree to that,
he said, more surprised than angry.
You're the one who lost the bet,
I returned, hoping my smile masked the fear. He chuckled, as if I was finally starting to understand him.
That's the only true thing you've said all day. Okay, Thomas, you win.
Hickok pulled another deck of cards from his vest pocket and cleared the remnants of the previous deck from the table.
I'll deal the cards. It's your job to call my bluff. You know how to play?
I realized he needed a distraction, and I would just have to cope.
Of course I can play, I said. But I'm the worst poker player this side of the Mississippi. Hickok laughed. It struck me that no matter what newsworthy story came out of this experience, I now had my own story of Wild Bill Hickok, and anyone for the remainder of my life would want to hear the close-up details of my encounter. The absurdity of his high-pitched laugh, the kindness in his eyes when he wasn't on the verge of defending himself.
Thanks for being here, Thomas,
he said, staring at the bottle I had pushed away from him. On some level, I was there to comfort Hickok. I just hoped I would have the opportunity to be more than an anonymous human barrier in an ambush.
Looking back,
he began,
I was just a farm boy. My father was the real hero, but I wouldn't discover this until it was too late.
I had no idea what Hickok was talking about. For that reason, I ignored the cards he dealt to me and uncorked my ink bottle, fully aware that the night was short, and my written words might not see the light of day.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that excerpt from Dead Man's Hand, a historical novel about Wild Bill Hickok's life. We sure had fun writing it and adapting my dad's screenplay into novel format. And if you click the link and subscribe, you will be able to track when that does come out, and you'll be able to have a chance to get your hands on an advanced reader copy. Also, you'll be able to track our progress as we finish editing the docudrama Dead Man's Hand. And my dad is also going to be coming out with an album of his original music that goes along with the project as well. So until next time, this is Dan Heidelin.